working on these shows at the Directors Guild, which is kind of an extra bonus, is that we get residuals, which is kind of nice. So it's a little bit of an extra bonus during the year. You never know when they're going to show up, and you get a, you know, check in the mail for, you know, some of the shows to do. Sometimes you get 30 checks in the mail at the same time, all for 17 cents. And you're like, oh. Like, you see the thick packet come, you're like, all right. So I said it to the sense. But it's, that is definitely a bonus of being in the Directors Guild.
Welcome to Self-Equity, the podcast that dives into the inspiring journeys of founders, entrepreneurs, athletes, and entertainers. I'm your host, Jolene Tepedino, authorized officer and team business manager for the Zellniger, Dorfman, Carr, and Heritage Group at UBS. On today's episode of Self-Equity, we're joined by Kenny Roth, a veteran production professional whose work has quietly shaped some of the most influential television of the last few decades. Kenny is an award-winning assistant director and unit production manager who has spent his career at the intersection of creativity, logistics, and leadership, making the impossible happen on set while protecting the people doing the work. His credits span a remarkable range of modern television, from Deadwood, which earned him a DGA award, to other shows like Brooklyn Nine-Nine, The Good Place, Perry Mason, and most recently, he's worked on the breakout hit Nobody Wants This. Kenny, welcome to our Self-Equity podcast. Great to have you on.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Excellent. I'm excited for you to share your amazing story. So let's get right into it. I'd like to talk a bit about your career. Specifically, what is the path to where you are today? And how did you discover, you know, way back when, that this is what you wanted to do?
Sure. I went to Indiana University. And while I was there, I started taking some entertainment classes. I never really thought I was going to go into the entertainment industry just because I didn't know anything about it. And, you know, I grew up in a little town in Massachusetts. And, you know, I just always thought that growing up, you basically got married, had two kids, and worked for a business. I was very sheltered. I didn't know what was out there. And so when I went to Indiana, it was kind of a bit of an eye-opening experience because I planned on going into the business school until I found out you had to keep up a certain grade point average. And I guess I just wasn't the greatest student, and I knew that I probably was not getting into the business school. So I started taking these entertaining classes, and I also started announcing some basketball and football at the university, which was a lot of fun. And it sort of got me interested in the business, originally maybe thinking I could be an announcer. But I sort of shifted gears over to the TV and radio world through some classes. And I really didn't know what I wanted to do until I, you know, decided I wanted to move to California. I had called an old camp counselor of mine because she is a casting agent in California. And I asked her about the business. And I asked her, you know, I was thinking about getting into it and whether, you know, moving to New York or Los Angeles was a better option. She was out of Los Angeles and suggested LA just because there was a lot more TV shows, movies going out to California. So I picked up without knowing anybody and moved out to LA. I had a few, you know, odd jobs in terms of entertainment. It's really, I've been out here for 34 years in Los Angeles and have never had any other job other than in the entertainment business. I started working as a, you know, production assistant in some offices, whether it was an editing room or just going out, getting lunches, you know, driving tapes back and forth between Hollywood and Santa Monica, or being what they call a runner, which is just running stuff all over Los Angeles, or sweeping stages. So I finally got working on a Hallmark Hall of Fame productions, working in the office. And I did that probably for 2 years as sort of an LA coordinator. And they finally said, listen, you know, you've done what you can do here. What do you want to do next? And I said, you know, I'd really like to try to go and work on a set. And they sent me out to North Carolina. And I worked on a set, and I fell in love with it. I was like, this is amazing. Like being out here, being around all these people. And, you know, I was 22 or 23 years old at this point. And, you know, everybody else, you know, the older, you know, Fort folks, like the Teamsters, they're like, ah, you're young. You'll eventually get bitter. You'll see. But I stuck with it. And the way to start is becoming a production assistant. You make no money. You work hard. You work a lot of hours and you work your way up. And fortunately, I did over the years, and I got into the Directors Guild. And the first job in the Directors Guild is a second assistant director. And then from being a second, I moved up to a second assistant director, then eventually a first assistant director, and eventually to a unit production manager. So it's taken, you know, a long time, and I feel like I've paid my dues, but that's the path that I took.
I love that path. And to those who said you'd get better, they can, you know, go where, you know, you never did. You are not in the least bitter. Certainly not a word I'd use to describe you.
Oh, I'm one of those old guys now that when people come to set, I am the bitter one now, for sure.
So,
yeah,
for us, you know, on the outside looking in, the director or UPM or any title, really, you know, anything on a hit show or a show sounds so glamorous to us, right? But from your seat, from the inside, what does that role actually feel like when a show is working? And what does, you know, your day-to-day entail?
Sure. Well, I, you know, it is, it's not all that glamorous. I mean, you know, I think for somebody coming out for the first time, I guess it would be seeing some of the sets. But there's a lot, you know, the one thing I do like about the industry is that things are different every single day. Like every day, it's not just coming into the office every day and making the same calls and talking to the same people. You're always doing something different. And for my job, there's really two parts to my job. There is a prep, and then there is a shoot. And the prep is just what it sounds like. It's a lot of prep. It is a lot of meetings. It is a lot of scouting of locations. It's a lot of putting together. My job is to put together a schedule. So basically, I take a script, and I break it down scene by scene. And within each one of those scenes, there's a certain program called Entertainment Partner Scheduling, and a program that I use to input what costumes we might need for a scene, whether it's interior or exterior, whether it's day or night, how long is the scene, any props or special effects or stunts, all these different elements that get put into each scene. Then you have meetings. You have costume meetings, you have props meetings with the director, and I'm working hand in hand with the director as the first AD, and the two of us get together. And we go on scouts, we look at pictures, we look at background, we look at, you know, background pictures, like how many people we want in a restaurant scene or which directions we're going to be looking when we go out on scouts. And my job is to really put together a schedule that it all makes sense and do it in a way that is cost efficient. You know, you don't want to go back to the same restaurant three different times when you could do shoot the three different scenes in one day. It's much easier. So those are the things I have to figure out. And a lot of times you have to think about, okay, what, if this is day, is this is night, how many hours in the day you're going to be working. So it's a lot of that during prep. There are a lot of meetings. And if you do a good prep, shooting should be a little bit easier. It should make it so that on day one, when you start shooting, you know the angles you're looking at. You know how many background. Then it's just a matter of getting everybody ready, you know, putting actors through hair and makeup, putting background through hair and makeup, lighting the set, rehearsing, and eventually finally shooting. Like, you know, you watch a show sometimes and there's like, you know, one scene, and that scene could have taken 8 hours to shoot. But there are different angles and different directions and different cameras and special equipment. So when I'm on set, I'm calling rolls and cuts and a lot of times action and cutting for the director. Making sure the background looks right, make sure there aren't, you know, crew members in the shot, that my PA is doing a good job of making sure that nobody's walking through the set and that it's absolutely silent, that cell phones are off and all that stuff. And every day is different. You know, there's always problems to solve every day. So the glamour of it is like, you know, could be like one scene that's really funny, but when you do it 20 times in a row, the luster sort of comes off it a little bit. You're like, okay, well, can't laugh that many times. It's like, it was funny, about 2 hours ago, but now it's taking too long and somebody can't remember their lines, or the director wants to do another shot and all of a sudden it's not funny anymore. So a lot of glamour is, meeting some of the actors, depending on who's in. And I think that sort of has worn off, quite a bit over the years, because some people you just think they're a pain in the ass. Some people are extremely nice and they're kind and you like them. I've been fortunate in my career to have worked with some really wonderful people on set. So I feel like I've been lucky in that respect.
That's amazing, Kenny. And I don't think most people know what actually goes into, putting a show together, putting a production together, getting a half hour episode of something, right? I mean, there's so much that goes into it. I want to talk a little bit about money. How does the conversation in the room change once a show becomes a hit? Once everyone knows there could be real, money involved, what is that like?
Well, it's different for different crew members. Everybody has their rate. Everybody has a standard rate that you determine at the beginning of the show. All the shows that I work on are all union shows. Now, in non-union shows or commercials, you could sort of make your own rate, and they pay a little bit more in commercials because they have a lot more backing, and a lot of these agencies pay a lot more. But in terms of the shows that I work on, there are union rates, and a lot of people do ask for more than their rate, and a lot of people get more than their rate. That's mostly the above the line people, directors, actors. There's no real set rate for one of the main actors. They sort of make their own deals. But for below the line people, the money is sort of set early on. So even if the show is a hit, the crew does not make any more money because the show is a hit. They hit their standard rate. And to be honest with you, if a show is a hit, the studio, say whether it's Netflix or Amazon or Apple or anybody, a lot of times if you come in under budget or on budget, the next season they will come to you and say, well, you did it for this much last year, can you do it for less next year? They don't give you more money when a show is a hit. They actually give you less money. And it's kind of a bummer because the crew, especially when I'm working as a production manager, the crew will say, well, this is an Apple TV show. You must have tons of money and more money to give us, and we should get a higher rate. And it's like, well, unfortunately, that's not the way it works. They give us a certain specific budget that we have to stick to. And so, once the show gets kicking, there's not a lot of talk about money. But I will say that, during the show, there are certain things like, say you need a drone all of a sudden. You start dealing with drone companies and creating rates for those drones. There's a lot of different, companies out there. And a lot of people in Los Angeles are not working right now. So you can usually get a pretty good deal. But that's the same with like insert cars or locations that you go to. A lot of location managers have to deal with the asking price of a restaurant to shoot there, or a neighborhood, or different houses. If you want to shoot in somebody's house, you can offer them $10,000 a day to shoot. And, when you're prepping there, like taking all their furniture out of their house and putting in our own furniture, they usually charge about half that for a prep day and a full amount for the shoot day. So there is money, but it's not so much with the crew. It's sort of outside vendors that you're dealing with during the show that I'll make deals with, or the location manager will make deals with.
How do you decide to work on a project?
Well, sort of whoever calls. At this point in my career, I want to work with people that I like. I want to work with producers that I've worked with before. I want to work with a good crew, whether it's a director. Because for me, the important people for me are obviously the producers, the director of photography, kind of the department heads. And I've been fortunate to work with some really good ones. And that will determine if I want to do a job or not. If a show I worked on last year, I'll do it again. Because I like the people. Or if it's an actor that I like that asked me to do a show, I'll probably do that show. My rates are generally all the same. I never really asked for any more. Some people in my position ask for 10% more or 20% more. And for me, I like what I do. I feel like I make, you know, enough money, you know, on these jobs, and I like doing it. So deciding on a job is, you know, it's me calling out to people and finding out what's going on, or just getting calls from other people.
Kenny, on a hit show like Brooklyn Nine-Nine, where timing is everything and the schedule can be brutal, how do you decide what is worth fighting for and what isn't?
Brooklyn Nine-Nine, honestly, was, we never really had that problem. We moved fast. The actors all knew their lines. There was a lot of, ad-libbing that was going on, especially for the jokes. And a lot of times they would say, oh, we have three of jokes we want you to try. And at a certain point, you have to tell the writers, okay, that's enough. Like, stop, like, coming up with more. We just don't have the time to just keep doing it over and over again. There are always time constraints every day, every show. My job is, what I do is slide on a call sheet, which is basically the sheet of paper that everybody gets every single day. And what's on that sheet of paper is everybody's name, what time they have to be in work that day, what we're shooting, what order we're shooting in, what actors are there, who is coming in at what time hair and makeup's coming in. And so I do a timeline on that call sheet. So like the first scene I say is going to go from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. Then we're going to shoot from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. the next scene. Then we're going to break for lunch for an hour. And then we're going to come back at 2 o'clock and we're going to shoot from 2 o'clock to 6 p.m. that third scene. And then we have to wrap. You know, my allegiance is to the producer and also to the director. So I have to sort of walk a little bit of a tightrope between the two of them to sort of satisfy everybody and to get the day done in a right amount of time. Because after, with union workers, after 8 hours, everybody goes into a certain amount of overtime. And everybody starts making time and a half after 8 hours. And, you know, or the budget, as a production manager, when I'm doing the budget, I'll budget a day. And, okay, I know everybody's probably going to work 12 hours today. So that's in the budget. Once it starts going past that, people start getting into double time, and it gets really expensive for the budget.
Kenny, can you share with us some of your favorite actors or favorite, you know, some of your favorite shows that you worked on or an experience that really, you know, resonated with you when meeting someone that, you know, you thought would go one way and went a different way?
You know, the first time I ever really got really excited and had a really cool experience was I was a PA in the production office on a movie called Wayne's World, like 100 years ago. And I had never been on a set before. My job was basically just to follow Lorne Michaels around and just go to set with him, go back to the office with him, get him lunch. And one day, one of the PAs on that set said, go down to base camp and get this actor and bring him to set. I was like, okay, I don't even know what base camp means. And so they had explained to me everything. I went down and I knocked on the guy's door and he came out and the guy said, oh, this is my first movie. I'm kind of nervous. I'm like, yeah, I've never really been on a set either. And it was Chris Farley. And I was like, oh, this is pretty cool. Like later on, like nobody knew what was going to happen with him. And he was super nice. He was great. And then in terms of like once I started working on set, I remember the probably one of the best people I've ever worked with, and I've met a lot of good people on this, was a movie called Primary Colors, which was a Mike Nichols directed film loosely based off of a book, kind of based on Bill and Hillary Clinton back in the day. But Emma Thompson was an actor who I worked with. And I don't think I've ever met a nicer person in my life. She was just incredible and super nice. And we all went to New York to shoot the rest of the show. And she gave me a wrap gift of a really nice gift certificate to Barney's of New York. And she said, meet me at my, you know, brownstone. We'll go to Central Park. We'll get lunch. And then I'll take you shopping at Barney's. I'm like, you know, I was making $400 a week, I think I was making at the time. And so like we walked into Barney's and I'm like, what, a pair of socks, $150? What the hell's going on here? We also had Kathy Bates on that show and John Travolta and Maura Tierney and Billy Bob Thornton was on that show also. And after that show ended, Billy asked me if I wanted to be his assistant. And I decided I didn't want to because I wanted to sort of follow the dream of getting into the Directors Guild and being a PA. But he brought me out to another movie in Texas called All the Pretty Horses, and I was a PA on that. And then I worked with him on Bad Santa, and he kind of kickstarted my career because I met another couple of ADs who brought me along on a lot of their shows. And so it was a really good starting point for me becoming an AD, thanks to Billy and what he sort of did for me bringing me on. So that was a great experience. He was wonderful. On Brooklyn Nine-Nine, every one of those actors were fantastic. Like, I still keep it tucked with quite a few of the actors that I've worked with over the years, whether it was Brooklyn Nine-Nine or The Good Place or The Newsroom or Deadwood even. I just have a bunch of people from Deadwood that I still keep in touch with. And Tim Oliphant and Kim Dickens, two people who I just adore. And I've just been really lucky to work with a lot of these people on the shows, and I just had such a great relationship with them. And just the respect that they gave me and the way they treated me has always been pretty, pretty special.
Penny, that's amazing. And just talking to you, I'm reminded of all the shows and all the work that you have done. And I'm so glad that we're able to talk about it. I hope this is, you know, also reflective for you. I don't know how often you get to tell your story or talk about all the amazing work that you've done. But I mean, this rattling off of shows and things, I mean, amazing shows, just incredible, incredible shows that connect with people. Which brings me to, you know, your most recent show, I believe, Nobody Wants This, which really connected quickly with audiences, myself included. That was such an amazing storyline, and the characters also felt so perfectly cast. For you, what felt different about that show compared to, you know, other shows that you've worked on in the past?
You know, I got on that show because another actor who I didn't mention, but Kristen Bell, I worked with her on The Good Place, and she had asked me if I would come over and do Nobody Wants This. It just sounded like a great concept, about the whole thing. And being Jewish, I was, you know, full on in, and I just love Kristen. I would do anything for her. And once I met the rest of the crew, like the producers and all the other actors, it was pretty amazing. Like, starting on a new show, you don't know how shows are ever going to be when you start. You know, you can read the script and you can say, oh, this is really good. And you just hope that when it does come out to the public that they really like it. Working on that, I knew that it definitely was something special because they were all really just wonderful people. And the creators of the show, Erin and Sarah Foster, it's loosely based on Erin's life. She had married a Jewish man. He's not rabbi, that sort of got added in. But it was really special to kind of work on that, especially being Jewish. And I was able to sort of help with like a bat mitzvah that we shot in the first season. Like, you know, I was able to help with that. And, you know, they had some really great directors and our producers were fantastic. And I had to interview some people to be on my staff. And I just got lucky because my staff is just fantastic. And I've worked with them the last few years and they are like the backbone of the entire show. My second AD and my second sec AD and the PAs, you really rely on them for everything. And they are just wonderful. You know, the budget is, it's low. You'd be shocked like at the budget compared to like other shows. You know, we try to save money as much as we can. You know, producer telling you, well, you know, we need 50 background in this scene. He's like, you can have 20. And it's like, oh, all right. Well, you got to tell the director. It's like, okay, listen, we're not getting the 50 background that we wanted. We can only do half. So let's creatively figure out how we can make it look crowded without it being crowded. So there's a lot of that on the show. After the first season and when it came out and the success of it, I was so happy. I was so excited. And, you know, we did obviously a second season, and now I start in a couple of weeks on the third season. Most of the same people came back because we wanted everybody back. So it was such a good group of people. For me, working on this show is at the Directors Guild, which is kind of an extra bonus, is that we get residuals, which is kind of nice. So it's a little bit of an extra bonus during the year. You never know when they're going to show up and you get a, you know, check in the mail for, you know, some of the shows to do. sometimes you get 30 checks in the mail at the same time, all for 17 cents. And you're like, oh. Like, you see the thick packet come, you're like, all right. It's only 17 cents. But it's that is definitely a bonus of being in the Directors Guild. It's a strong union. And listen, I think everybody deserves a piece of the show, because everybody works just as hard. The director of photography, design, production designer, script supervisor, grips, electrics. Everybody deserves a piece of that pie. Danny back to nobody wants this. Sorry, I got off track here. It's fun. Every day on set is fun. We don't work a ton of hours. The actors know their lines. They're funny. The directors that we've all had know how to get through a day with my and my team's help in terms of speeding things along and making sure that things are in place. That car's in a driveway. We've got traffic all set up. We've got a lock up on a street. We've got the right, you know, furniture inside the house. The props are always there. So it's a lot of that stuff. It's a really great team of people all working together. And it's if I could work on the show the rest of my career, I would just do it. It's so great.
Wow, Kenny. That's amazing. And no, thank you for that information. I remember a couple of years ago during the strike, I remember speaking to you and, you know, you're just like waiting for it to end. And so what I want to talk to you a little bit about is, you know, the in-between shows, you know, when you're not working, and also how has your relationship changed with money, you know, throughout the years?
Sure. I think, you know, in between shows, you just have to be smart. You know, you have to find the right things to do with your money. You can't be silly. Listen, I don't have kids. I invest my money. I am smart with it. The people that I work with are really, really smart. And they've obviously done a wonderful job for me. So I'm able to take those months off and to not worry too much. I'm always pretty confident that I'm going to get another job. Because you don't, you know, it's great when you are working on a job and you know what's coming up next. You know, like when my job, I worked on an HBO show called The Comeback with Lisa Kudrow that finished in November. When that was over, I knew that I had Nobody Wants This coming back in probably February or, you know, sometime, which is when it is. So I'm able to, you know, look at the money that I have and listen, I work so I can spend money. I love spending money. I'm careful with my future, and I know what sort of lies out there, and I have a pretty good handle on what I want to do and what I want to spend my money on. I travel a lot, but in particular, I am still kind of a dork where I balance my checkbook, and I've got, you know, my business account, my personal account, and I'm a corporation, so I pay myself, and I do hold off on paying myself when I'm not working. To avoid any of those taxes. But I do, you know, I still get, terrible to say, but I still get paper statements and I go through and I check off each one, make sure every time my account is balanced. I think just being by myself, I like to know where I'm at all times. My financial advisors are a big help in that as well, and telling me, you know, how to plan for the future, what I should do for the future, which gives me the confidence to be able to spend what I want to spend and know what I want to do. I usually take off 2 to 3 months a year, which is fine. I'm able to travel during that time. I've never been a 9 to 5, you know, every day, 2 weeks off a year on vacation. I never even had that. You know, most people in the world, that's what they have. They have a job. They get a certain amount of vacation time. With the entertainment industry, it's a lot different when you're working on sets. You know, a job ends. And some people don't get another job for 2, 3, 4 months. And because of the slowdown in California right now, there are people that are switching their careers. And people have been off work for a long time. And knock on wood, I've been fortunate to, the longest I've ever been out of work was maybe 3 months, not including the pandemic and, you know, during strike. During that time, I tried not to be stupid and spend money that I don't have. And I know what I have, and I've saved enough money where I can take that time off. And I just want to keep, you know, going. I do have a certain retirement date set, and I just want to make sure I reach sort of my goals in terms of my money and where I want to be, and make sure that I know I'll be able to finish when I want to finish, or only work one job a year. Like, Nobody Wants This will go from February to May. I do have something lined up after that. I don't know if I wanted to do it or not yet. It's another unit production manager job. I'm still deciding. But that would take me till probably past Thanksgiving. So it would be a great year, you know, and I, you know, be able to save a lot more money. So we'll see. But I do, you know, I think everybody out here thinks about money. I think a lot of people in this industry have, you know, overextended themselves sometimes, unfortunately. And it's like, ah, shit, you know, they bought this boat or they bought this bike or they bought this car. And now the mortgage is tough because nobody's getting work anymore. And it's tough. It's really a shame for everybody. I wish there was work for everyone and that everybody was just happy and working all the time. But it's been a little difficult in the industry over the past couple of years, seeing, you know, friends looking for work. And I get a lot of calls from people, you know, if you hear of anything, and people that are like, oh my God, you're so good at your job. I can't believe you're not working. It's kind of shocking. But personally, I've been lucky. And to have met some really good people that still want to hire me. And so I feel pretty fortunate.
Kenny, one question we like to ask everyone on the podcast is, what does sweat equity mean to you?
I guess money that, you know, you have worked hard for. I'm not really sure, to be honest with you. Well, that's in my head what I think about. It's, you know, the equity that I've put in to everything, and the, you know, sort of blood, sweat, and tears that I've put into the hard work that I've done over the years.
Exactly. Kenny, thank you so much for joining us today. It was amazing hearing your story and also learning a lot more about you. I'm so excited to see all the amazing work that you continue to do, and I look forward to getting together soon.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a pleasure talking with you and meeting Jordan. You guys are awesome. Thank you. What a great podcast.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review Client Relationship Summary, provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.